You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of October, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with ABC News London correspondent Jeffrey Kaufman. What's on the agenda today, Jeffrey?
Well, what's old is new again in journalism. Welcome to a new paper with a kind of familiar name, the International New York Times.
Also on the program, it's a $5 million prize for simply doing your job. Then why is it that the fourth time in 5 years they can't find a winner in Africa?
And how is this for a bleak future? We'll speak to the artist behind a new exhibition that paints a scary picture of how our everyday objects might look in a post-apocalyptic future.
You know, for me, it's sort of about taking something from the past and projecting it over the present into the future. It creates this confusion of time, which is where I like the work to reside.
And as the Architecture and Design Film Festival in New York is about to begin, we discuss the role of film as a tool to spread new ideas through design.
And you can really talk about design in a way through film, if done right, that's really expansive. And the real goal is really, you know, to up the level of design conversation across the board.
All that plus we play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy 60 minutes up ahead, but before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. US senators say they're closing in on a deal that would reopen the government and push back a possible default for several months ahead of Thursday's deadline. The Senate's top Democrat and top Republican both said they were optimistic they could soon reach an agreement that would allow them to avert the looming default and end a partial government shutdown that's dragged on for 14 days so far. Senator Harry Reid, the Democrat majority leader, acknowledged what he called constructive, good faith negotiations with the Republican leader Mitch McConnell. Mr. McConnell agreed the signs were promising.
Let me just echo the remarks of my good friend, the majority leader. We've had an opportunity over the last couple of days to have some very constructive exchanges of views about how to move forward. Those discussions continue, and I share his optimism that we're going to get a result that will be acceptable to both sides.
At least 20 people have been killed after an earthquake measuring 7.2 hit the central Philippines. The quake struck at a depth of about 35 kilometers around Bohol Island to the north of Mindanao. The Pacific Tsunami Warning Center in Hawaii said there was no threat of a Pacific-wide tsunami after the quake. Four of the dead were killed when a fish market collapsed. Two others died and 19 were injured when the roof of another market came down. Authorities in India's eastern state of Odisha say 15 people were killed as Cyclone Phalen slammed in from the ocean. Most died under falling trees and one was crushed when the walls of her mud hut fell in. Cyclone Phalen is expected to ease by this morning, but Chief Minister Navin Patnaik says restoring power supplies remains a major concern.
So we are concentrating on necessary relief materials, food and medical supplies, which are reaching the people. Roads have been more or less fixed. Power will take some time in certain places, but there's been a great deal of damage done to the electrical works.
The European Union's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, says she's come to Geneva with cautious optimism as she prepares to hold talks with Iran on its nuclear program. Negotiations are due to start in the Swiss city later today. They'll be the first since the June election of President Hassan Rouhani. He's a relative moderate who wants to improve Iran's relations with the West to secure the removal of sanctions that have damaged its oil-based economy. Ashton represents the so-called P5+1 nations of the United States, Russia, China, France, Britain and Germany who are taking part in the talks. She says she's hoping that the 2 days can produce positive results.
I was very pleased that we agreed to come to Geneva with Minister Zarif and his team to continue the discussions. I hope that what we'll have here is a very productive 2 days, an opportunity to explore both the proposals that we have put on the table, but also ideas that are coming from Iran. We come here with cautious optimism, but a real sense of determination.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservatives and the Social Democrats say they're likely to hold a third round of talks later this week to explore the possibility of forming a coalition government. After 8 hours of discussions, Hermann Gröhe, second in command of Merkel's Christian Democrats, said they had agreed to meet again on Thursday to discuss reviving the 2005-2009 Grand Coalition with the SPD. Merkel needs to find a partner for her third term after she won September's election, but without an absolute majority. The CDU is due to hold talks with the smaller Green Party later today. Polls suggest the public would like her to enter full-blown negotiations with the SPD rather than the Greens. Owners of dogs of all shapes and sizes came together outside Mexico's finance ministry on Monday to protest against proposed tax changes that would levy a 16% sales tax on pet food. The owners say the increase would lead to increasing malnutrition in pets and an increase in abandoned animals. The government's tax reform plan has opted out of applying the sales tax to food, but proposed levying it on pet food, arguing that it's not for human consumption. It's estimated that 14 million of Mexico's 27 million cats and dogs are homeless. And activists argue that the tax will only make things worse. Mexico's lower house must approve the bill by Sunday. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Barney Burnham. It is 16:06 in Tokyo, 11:06 in Moscow, and 8:06 in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. It's time now to set the day's news agenda. We're joined in the studio today by Jeffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News. Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Well, shall we begin? 2 days away from default day.
Day 14
Armageddon's
of the
fast approaching.
It's unbelievable. Day 14 of the government shutdown in the U.S. and. Yes, if this isn't resolved by Thursday, we really, what seems to all of us outside of the U.S. Who aren't experiencing the inconvenience, it really is a financial apocalypse, we're told, and it does seem to be one. And there is a recognition, even by the intransigent Republicans, it seems, that something has to be done. It is a really interesting, it's kind of a wild west there with just facing off the two of them. And it's become a matter of pride for these far-right Republicans. They just don't want to give ground.
And there's been ever-increasing concern abroad as well. For example, IMF's Christine Lagarde warned yesterday that if this doesn't get sorted, the whole world could go into recession. Do you think these outsider warnings are going to have any effect?
Well, I think what may have more effect is the inside warning, which is that the Republican popularity is at the lowest level ever. And what you have are two Republican parties effectively in the United States. You have the business wing, the sort of traditional Republican Party, and then you have the Sarah Palin, Ted Cruz, far-right Tea Party rump. Which controls enough that they can make life miserable for not just the Republicans, but the entire, you know, the Republicans control one of the two houses of Congress. They control the House of Representatives. They don't control the Senate. They don't control the White House. And yet, and you have this minority within that majority in the House of Representatives that is essentially the tail wagging the dog. This group is just so ideologically driven that they don't care. And, you know, some would accuse them of saying, some would say that they would rather see the economy fail and Obama fail than America, than allow Obama to succeed. And we saw that on Sunday. There was a rally. Sarah Palin and Ted Cruz had a rally that was really quite ugly. People with Confederate flags, people calling for the impeachment of Obama. I mean, this is, I really think that this is a very personal thing about Obama. I think there is a section of America that cannot fathom Barack Obama as president.
There there does seem to be some potential hope on the horizon. The Senate, McConnell and Reid hashing out some kind of a plan that would see the debt ceiling raised until something like February. The government could potentially be funded until January. But the big question is, even if the Senate comes together with some plan, it's up to the man at the House, John Boehner, whether he will put that bill to a vote. So it's really up to, he's the man that could potentially set the course of the country.
Well, you know, Boehner wants to keep his job, and his problem is that he's got to keep that far-right Tea Party rump in the fold, or they're going to defenestrate him. So it's just not clear. He can't really control them, but watch carefully. Today is an important day.
And moving on to your second story about New York. The International Herald Tribune, the global edition of the New York Times, has become the International New York Times. This is the day we've been waiting for.
You know, well, you may have been waiting for it, but I remember coming to Europe for the first time, I think it was in 71, with my family, and picking up the International Herald Tribune, it seemed so exotic. It seemed like
it was very romantic,
oh my
wasn't
gosh.
It?
You know, I was but a wee thing, but I do remember that sense of you really were a traveler when you saw the International Herald Tribune. And of course, now it's really just another going to become another edition of the New York Times. It's 125 years old. It's gone through a lot of different names. In 2002... until 2002, it was owned jointly by the Washington Post, the New York Times. The Times pushed out the Post, and this was kind of inevitable as they rebrand and go global. I mean, we're seeing this in the media in general. The Guardian is, in its own way, doing that here in London as it tries to become an international newspaper with its very significant offices in New York. It's just opened offices in Australia. The Guardian has more readers online often in the U.S. than it does in the U.K. The New York Times is a bigger global brand and clearly trying to capitalize. Essentially, anything that doesn't have the name New York Times, they have jettisoned. The Boston Globe, About.com, all gone as the New York Times probably rightly, if not romantically, capitalizes on its brand as an international brand. It's kind of funny, though, when you think about International New York Times. It is a kind of almost an oxymoron in the title, isn't it?
Do you think
it
was necessary? Because the IHT had such a strong brand recognition
yes,
around
because,
the world.
Yes, because it's not about the IHT. It's about extending the New York Times brand. It's about really getting people to become loyal New York Times fans and ultimately, I suppose, driving people to the paywall and the website as well. And
do you think that it's going to work?
Yes, I do. I think, you know, branding works. And I think, hey, this, I'm sitting at Monocle. I mean, this is the house of branding, and you know, and it's effective. I think that you need to get people to recognize what it is you're selling. And after all, let's face it, the content since 2002 has been the New York Times with its own spin. The news, this paper is produced out of Paris, but it is more and more. It's drifted closer and closer into the fold of the New York Times, the gray lady of Manhattan, and so yeah, I think it's a business decision, and it does make sense.
Well, one company that perhaps could use a bit of a rebranding is our good friends at BlackBerry.
Do you think they want to be called Monocles or something like that? Look in your paper today in 30 papers in 9 countries and an open letter saying, you know, we're going to survive. Don't abandon us. Technology advisory group this week told people that they should be abandoning their BlackBerries, that BlackBerry doesn't have a future. That's a really serious, serious move. And you know, given that BlackBerry lost $1 billion, in the last quarter, the company is in peril. I mean, what happened to Palm and Palm Pilot? What happened to, you know, all of these devices? And you know, is it going to be the next casualty?
The mobile phone business in general is going through quite a big change. It's coming from the Nokia land, you know, that doesn't really manufacture mobile phones anymore, Finland. I was wondering if they should have published a letter as well to customers to reassure them. Do you think it's going to make any difference?
You know, I it's really interesting to watch the hubris of BlackBerry's owners and founders. You could see it a few years ago. I remember having some dealings as a journalist with them, and they were just, you couldn't touch them. You couldn't. They didn't want to grant interviews unless they knew the terms. And they you know, I deal with a lot of famous people and a lot of influential people, and I thought, guys, like, people use your product. You should be, you know, what's wrong with talking to people about it? And I just think that they believed that they were really were unimpeachable. And you know, now look at this. But yeah, it's a volatile technology world. I mean, I, you know, you guys both have Apple computers sitting here. I'm looking and thinking, do you think in 20, 30 years, they will be the computer of record? I mean, right now, it seems inconceivable they wouldn't be. But, you know, I think brands come and go.
Well, even Apple having their very own problems when it comes to their new iPhone 5C in China, they've already had production of that product in China just because people aren't buying it. And perhaps that indeed is the start of the decline, who knows, of Apple.
You know, I think the funny thing about the smartphones, I still have, I'm an old guy, I've got the iPhone 4S, because I don't really think the difference between the 4 and the 5 is enough to justify pitching one and getting the other. And I think there was a period not too many years ago when you had to get the latest phone, and I get mine from my company. But you now I just think it's so incremental, the differences. But BlackBerry missed that latest wave of innovation.
That was Jeffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News. Thank you very much for this.
Thank you.
Coming up, it's the $5 million prize awarded to the African leader for doing a good job. Problem is, for another year, there's no winner.
Aperitivo is the latest addition to the Monocle 24 lineup. Airing every weekday at 1800 hours London time, Aperitivo is the perfect way to digest the day's biggest stories. From our studios at Midori House and over a flat white with special guests at the Monocle Cafe, we'll feature a relaxed blend of conversation and analysis that you simply won't hear anywhere else. That's Aperitivo, airing every weekday at 1800 hours London time. Brought to you in association with the Glenlivet.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It is a beautiful brand that it's all about giving the consumer the best possible product. We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity. We bought into a factory.
We put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said brand strategy company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad poets and really didn't get what we were about.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick. Not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
You get obsessed about the details, and if you're making the same product day in, day out, you build this incredible product that is very difficult to replicate.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie. The time is 8:18 here in London. Now, imagine if you could be awarded $5 million just for doing your job properly. Well, that's exactly what the Mo Ibrahim Prize for Good Governance in Africa is meant to do. It's awarded annually to the African leader who was elected democratically, governed properly, helped improve the conditions of the country, and then, after his or her term is up, leaves office at the end of it.
Well, for the fourth time in 5 years, there isn't a winner. This year again, no African leader was able to meet the criteria of the award. So what is the problem, and does it simply paint a picture of bad governance across the continent? Joining us now to discuss this further is Simon Allison, senior reporter for South African newspaper The Daily Maverick. Welcome to the programme, Simon. You have also worked previously for the Mo Ibrahim Foundation. Could you tell us first, what exactly are the criteria for the potential winner?
Well, it's actually quite a stringent criteria, and I think it's sort of unfair to characterize it as an award simply for doing your job, because that is not the case. The number of leaders have not to have not received the award, despite being self-evidently competent at their jobs. What it is an award for exceptional leadership. So you need to be elected democratically. You need to leave office within your constitutionally mandated term. So no fiddling about with term limits in the Constitution. And while you have been in office, you really need to be exceptional. And that is the key criteria, and that's the most difficult to find.
Well, as Marcus said, four times out of the last 5 years, there hasn't been a winner. Does this prize do anything to help the concept or the idea of good governance or good leadership on the continent?
Well, that was one of the original intentions behind the prize, is to show that, yes, you know, we have good leaders, and we need to publicize them. And in the early years, when there were a couple of good leaders, Joaquim Chissano won it from Mozambique, and then Festus Mogae from Botswana, this was fulfilling that mandate, you know, publicizing these little-known leaders. And we've gone on to do good things in sort of the international diplomacy sphere, helped by the funds given to them by the prize. However, this repeated non-award of the prize is a real problem for the Murray Ibrahim Foundation, but also for the whole concept of African leadership. Now, of course, there are all sorts of negative stereotypes, perhaps justified, surrounding African leadership. And these headlines, you know, no African leadership award, no president worthy, they really don't help the situation. And I think the Mo Ibrahim Foundation needs to start thinking about ways to mitigate this situation.
And what kind of conclusions would you like to see in the end by the foundation?
I think a few people have suggested, you know, make the criteria for the award less restrictive and make it easier to win. I think that would be a mistake. You know, this is meant to be a prize for excellence. Let's keep it that way. That's fine. As Mary Robinson observed yesterday, the former Irish president, if you were to award the same prize in Europe for the last couple of years, you'd probably struggle to find a good candidate as well. But the problem is, I think, is that there's no other stories coming from the foundation. A really good, I think a good compromise would be to create another award recognizing perhaps a civil society figure or another government official, you know, a governor or a minister who is doing good work. Because there are plenty of examples of good African leadership that aren't necessarily at the head of state level.
Absolutely. This award, the Mo Ibrahim Prize, you know, it's all well and good to say here's this prize. There hasn't been a winner four times out of the last 5 years. But what is this foundation actually trying to actually do to help solve the problem, if there indeed is one?
Well, if you talk to anyone from the foundation, and certainly Mo Ibrahim himself, who set up the foundation, he is very clear that his priority is actually the Ibrahim Index of African Governance. The prize generates all the headlines because it's an interesting, you know, it's a good news story. But the real hard work goes into creating this ranking of how well African countries are governed. And there's something like 90,000 data points that go into this, which is quite astonishing because data in Africa is really hard to come by and really scarce. So managing to compile this and create the data where it hasn't already been there is a wonderful achievement. And what it gives is it's not necessarily a solution, but it is an important tool for civil society organizations, even for governments, to look and say, okay, this is, you know, this is an opinion. This is not a, you know, someone's perception. These are the numbers. What do the numbers say? Where are we doing well? Where are we doing badly? And they really raise some interesting conclusions. So from my country, South Africa, we can see that over the last 12 years or so, governance has pretty much stagnated. We're doing okay, but we haven't improved much. We haven't declined much, except in a couple of categories, one of which is personal safety. So South Africa, according to these numbers, it's becoming a more dangerous place. Now, this is obviously a good indication of where we as journalists and civil society need to be focusing and telling our government and pushing them on what to be doing.
Simon, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there, but many thanks for joining us on the program. Simon Allison, he's a senior reporter for the Daily Maverick in South Africa.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 15:24 in Shanghai, 10:24 in Helsinki and 8:24 here in London. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents from around the world. And today we head to Italy to speak with our correspondent in Milan, Ivan Cavallo. Welcome to the program. Shall we start with the latest with Silvio Berlusconi?
Yeah, good morning, Marcus. Silvio Berlusconi has asked that he wants to do community service. As you know, he was convicted for tax fraud. He's about to be expelled from the Italian Senate because of his conviction. And instead of going to house arrest because of his age, he's 77, he has the option of doing community service. So he wants to try to stay in the spotlight by being out in the public, even though he'll be doing tasks that you wouldn't expect for a billionaire media mogul.
And Ivan, this of course coincides with the Senate, who in a matter of weeks will vote on whether to expel him from his seat in Parliament. What's the latest on that situation, and does it look likely that he'll indeed be kind of thrown out of Parliament?
Yeah, I think the votes are there to expel him from the Senate and push him out of at least a role in Parliament. But of course, as you know, Beppe Grillo of the Five Star Movement, he's the leader, but he's outside of Parliament. So Berlusconi will lose his Senate seat and the ability to vote on key decisions. But he'll be definitely behind the scenes working with his party because he still seems in control, even because of the recent events with the no confidence vote that he challenged Letta and then backed down at the last minute.
And then moving on to your second story, during the last weeks we've been getting sad news from the Mediterranean regarding death of boat migrants. Italy is trying to work hard to prevent boats from leaving Libyan waters. What exactly is happening next?
Well, Enrico Letta's government has decided to put a lot of resources now into the Mediterranean in terms of they're going to have a task force with frigates and corvettes and an amphibious ship, helicopters, drones. So they're decided to try to tackle the problem at its source. So the migrants who are leaving from Libya, we have a big increase now because also refugees from Syria as well. And they're trying to tackle this at the root because the recent days there's been over 500 deaths just in the last few weeks. And they're trying to see if they can stop these migrants from leaving directly from Libya. It's a quite a complicated thing because you're dealing with territorial waters with Libya, and they're asking, of course, for European resources. Letta has to go to a summit later this month to ask for more money because he's rightly claiming that it's a European problem because Italy, unfortunately, bears the brunt because of geography.
Do we know if the Libyan government is willing or able to cooperate with the Italians on this issue?
In the past, previous governments, let's go back to Romano Prodi and others, they were working on doing coordinated patrols. So Italian Coast Guard, Italian military ships would help the Libyan coastal Coast Guard and Navy doing patrols there and helping them. Those measures in the past, in the recent past, haven't been going on because, of course, the instability that you've seen in Libya. So on that front now, Italy would be, you would think, would be trying to do some more measures with Libya, but the immediate concern right now for them is to bring out their naval forces and try to stem some of this flow.
Shall we move to aviation next? Alitalia is, well, once again in trouble.
Yeah, this is not a surprise. Alitalia is a flag carrier that is suffering, as you see. In a lot of places in Europe, we've seen flag carriers go under in the recent past, and it's asking the shareholders last night in a meeting that went quite late. We're asking to put more money in. The funny thing is now that nobody wants to touch this carrier. I mean, Aeroflot has said no, Lufthansa has said no, Air France and KLM, which own a 25% stake, they themselves are going through a difficult restructuring. And they don't see it necessary to put any more money in. I mean, Italy is obviously it's quite a lucrative market for tourism, but there's a lot of internal things going on that nobody sees an investment worthwhile right now.
And, of course, just news coming from yesterday as well, saying that International Airlines Group, which, of course, is the parent company to British Airways and Iberia, saying that the European Union should intervene in what they're calling Italy's illegal Alitalia rescue. Very briefly, though, Ivan, let's So that's perhaps some more sad news when it comes to other Italian companies in poor shape.
Yeah, no, the Italian situation is quite difficult right now. We've seen foreign companies come in, the French, particularly buy up luxury goods companies. Telecom Italia has been being acquired by Telefonica in Spain, and you think, okay, Spain, their economy is not perhaps in the best of shape, but Spanish companies are still more competitive than in Italy. And so these internal problems, and for example, the British Airways group saying that there's a state aid offer being made because the Italian post office is going to put some money in. The unions with Alitalia, a lot of people from the staff, the Fiesens are all based in Rome. It's long been a political football, Alitalia, that politicians and unions have been playing with. And unfortunately, the results are that now you have a weak flag carrier in a country that should have great services connections to all of its tourism resorts throughout the peninsula. But unfortunately, at this stage, it's looking like bankruptcy.
Ivan Cavallo, Monocle's man in Milan, thank you very much for this. This is Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the program, we leaf through this day's European papers. We meet Daniel Arsham, self-styled future archaeologist, and we take a look at the role of film in spreading new ideas in design and architecture.
But before all that, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. US senators say they're closing in on a deal that would reopen the government and push back a possible default for several months ahead of Thursday's deadline. The Senate's top Democrat and top Republican both say they're optimistic that they can soon reach agreement. At least 20 people have been killed after an earthquake measuring 7.2 hit the central Philippines. Four of the victims died when a fish market collapsed. Two others were killed and 19 more injured when the roof of another market came down. Authorities in India's eastern state of Odisha say 15 people were killed as Cyclone Phalen slammed in from the ocean. Most died under falling trees. One was crushed when the walls of her mud hut fell in. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, says she's come to Geneva with cautious optimism as she prepares to hold talks with Iran on its nuclear program. The negotiations are due to start in the Swiss city later today. German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservatives and the Social Democrats say they're likely to hold a third round of talks later this week to explore the possibility of forming a coalition government. Merkel needs to find a partner for her third term after she won September's election, but without an absolute majority. And owners of dogs of all shapes and sizes came together outside Mexico's finance ministry on Monday to protest against proposed tax changes that would levy a 16% sales tax on pet food. The dog owners say the increase in tax would lead to increasing malnutrition in pets and an increase in abandoned animals. Hopefully the street cleaners were on standby. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Barney. You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi and Phil Hahn. Architecture, a creative form intrinsic to our way of life, has, outside of the profession, remained esoteric and elitist to those looking in. Those eager to communicate the supposedly exciting new developments in the trade may look beyond preaching to the choir by conventional means and consider film as a tool to help spread the good word outside of the favoured circles.
The Architecture and Design Film Festival in New York attempts to do just that. Well, beginning tomorrow, this year's edition celebrates the work of architects and designers in over 30 films, from shorts to feature-length exploration of the creative processes of many leading practitioners. Section D producer Ali John caught up with architect and festival founder Kyle Bergman to find out why he thinks film is an appropriate medium for the discussion.
The megacity is a reality. And it looks a lot like the visions of science fiction films. Gigacities are soon to be. In the midst of this cold, bleak vision of the future, we have the human being. It is personal, warm, social.
We have actually a great opening night film, a Danish film called The Human Scale, about the work of Jan Gehl. And actually this year, the whole festival, there seemed to be a lot of films submitted that were about urbanism. And so we have this kind of, not because we created it, but just by what we selected, there's all these kind of interesting films on urban themes. And the Jan Gehl film is an amazing film, really looking at cities around the world. And Jan's got this, you know, he kind of says that we understand gorilla habitats, better than human habitats. And just by looking at all how we deal with cities, there's a lot that we could do better. And he's been working on this for about 40 years, so it's really great that we have a film on him.
Looking at that curatorial process that you undergo as the founder of the festival, what went into it this year? Were there any specific themes which you wanted to broach? Was urban design the main focus for you and the team, or was it very much a fluid process?
It's totally a fluid process. We really can't pick ahead of time what's going to kind of rise to the top. We look at almost 300 films each year getting ready for the festival, and between shorts and feature-length films. And we don't go in with any kind of premeditated, like the festival is going to be about this or about that. We'd really look and see what's available and see what makes sense. And then we program the festival so it's has a diversity to it, a diversity of ideas. And we're also interested, you know, I'm an architect, but I started this really as a way to increase the design dialogue between the architectural community and non-design community. And so all the films that we choose, hopefully interesting to everyone across the board, anyone who's interested in design at all.
So the audience isn't primarily a designer or an architect or someone from that community. You are hoping to target the broader aspect of society, people on the whole who could be interested in design, or of course architecture is something that we all live in, so it's an important festival for everybody.
Exactly. You know, I mean, we do about 50% are design professionals, but 50% come from everything, and the common thread of people who are interested in design. And when I started the festival, what I really wanted to do is increase the design dialogue. And if we just, as architects or designers, if we just talk to ourselves, it's a lot less interesting. It's much, much more interesting to have a broader conversation and dialogue. And the great thing about a film or film festival is that, you know, anyone can sit down and watch a film for an hour and a half and then sit in a bar or cafe afterwards. And the discussions is really in between the films are really what makes the festival exciting and interesting. I mean, that's the amazing part. Of course, we could all watch films at home, but it's much more fun to kind of come out and talk about them. And so we always do the festival in a venue that has a cafe or bar connected to it. So that's really the exciting part.
Before we get onto the content of some of the films, I wonder if we could talk a moment about the connection you see between film and architecture, and why, when you founded the festival, this was an important sort of marriage between different mediums.
There are so many similarities. I mean, they're both storytelling. I mean, it's kind of more clear with film, but in architecture, every time we pick a material or make decisions, we're telling a story. And so they're really both narrative. It's really important. They're both about light and scale and proportion. They're both collaborative processes where you know, the architect or the director is really responsible for pulling a lot of different elements together, you know, and hopefully the structural engineer knows more than the architect, and the director of photography knows more than the director. So it's a generalist pulling together a number of experts. So there's so many connections between architecture and film.
And looking at some of the films, then you mentioned before that you're including the work of urban designers such as Jan Gehr, William White, architects such as Anthony Gaudi. I wonder if you can talk a moment about, I haven't seen the films, we haven't seen the movies just yet. The festival is about to begin. What is the format? Are they feature length? Are they shorts? Are they 10 minutes, 15 minutes?
Yeah. So a whole spectrum of lengths, anything between our shortest film this year is 2 minutes and the longest film is 96 minutes. And what we do is we put together programs of films that are about 90 minutes long that are somehow content connected in a certain way, or they work together. And we program the feature length films first, and then we bring the shorts and other films together to create a program. And they're all documentaries, but they're really, we pick films that have human stories and are dynamic stories that are, sometimes when we use the word documentaries in the States, it can turn people off. And so they're really films about the creative process.
Watch. Paul Smith has tended to change the style of clothes slightly. He's just given men a little better dress sense, which is rare from an English designer.
Very British.
For me, wearing Paul Smith, it makes me happy. When I wear the clothes, I'm happy.
Great patterns, bright colours. Even though it's loads of flowers, it's just great because it's kind of discreet because it's in the lining.
We have films on Paul Smith, the clothing designer, and it's really about his design process. Films on Tadao Ando, actually a really beautiful German film about Ando's work, and it's beautiful, minimalist, austere film that goes really well with Ando's architecture. And a new film on Paolo Solari, who died this year, Italian architect who went to Arizona and started Arcosante, among other things. And that film is much more kind of like Solari. It has this little bit kind of groovier feeling, a little bit more kind of Southwest in a certain way feeling.
I think his legacy will be as an architectural futurist.
Paolo Solari planted the seed, you know, back in the 70s in my head, is how to have a connection between the natural environment and the built environment.
Even if I failed in applying this notion, in developing a prototype or whatever, somebody is going to pick it up after me.
In your lifetime, you think?
Well, it doesn't matter that much.
For you, the impetus for the festival, the birth of it was kind of the cause behind it was communication then, providing a window into the practices and the kind of connecting processes between sort of inspiration to industrial, you know, manufacturing and then implementation, is it?
Yeah, well, you know, I think I had thought about it for almost 5 years before I actually launched it. And, you know, what's great about film is you can tell stories about design that are richer than just still photography, I mean, or just text. And you can really talk about design in a way through film, if done right, that's really expansive. And the real goal is really, you know, to up the level of design conversation across the board. And, you know, that's good for us as professionals, but it's also good for society. And the goal of this is to learn a lot at the same time being entertained and having some fun. And film can be a really nice balance between those goals. And so far it's been working. It's been a lot of fun. We're in our fifth year now. We do it in New York, and we take this program to L.A. and then Chicago, and it's a lot of fun. People come and come back year after year. Once they get there, they realize I've got diverse, interesting, and fun.
That was Kyle Bergman, their architect and founder of the Architecture and Design Film Festival in New York. For more intriguing design stories, tune into Section D this evening, which premieres at 1900 hours London time, 1400 hours if you're listening to us from Toronto.
And now you're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after a short break with a journey into the archaeological future with artist Daniel Arsem.
All this week on The Globalist and The Globalist Asia, we delve into the world of espionage. We look at the work of secret security services around the world, explore the new ways governments are opting to spy on their rivals, and ask just who might be watching us and why. That's a series of special reports on espionage today, all this week on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, where the time is 9:42 in Barcelona. It's 8:42 here in London. Now, New York-based artist Daniel Arsem has launched his first exhibition in London last night. Taking now obsolete objects from our recent past, he seeks to crystallize their meaning and place in history. A self-styled archaeologist of the future, he has recast a series of relics of the not-so-distant past to look like they're fossilized or found in volcanic ash.
Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, met him in the studio to discuss his new London exhibition and some of his upcoming projects, which include a show in Singapore and a collaboration with musician Pharrell Williams.
Daniel, we hear as well that your exhibition starts today, actually. It's called Recollections. And in it, I think you see yourself as the archaeologist of the future. Why is that?
Much of my work is about taking things that people already know and they already have expectations about and shifting those things subtly. The exhibition that is on view here in London takes objects from, let's say, our recent past, things that we all know, have an inherent familiarity with, but that we no longer use, like old telephones, film cameras, film projectors. And I have remade these devices in materials that relate to geology, so volcanic ash and crystal, almost projecting them into the future.
What is the meaning of that? Because, I mean, all this kind of communication, you have a lot of, as you said, cameras, microphones. What did you want to transmit with that? But they're kind of eroded somehow.
They're almost as if they had been uncovered on some future archaeological dig. You know, I've remade these, let's say, the 35mm movie camera in volcanic ash, right? So much of my work is about creating this kind of confusion, and the show is very much about a confusion of time. There are also a series of paintings in the exhibition that are paintings of coins, but the coins are eroded. So they're contemporary coins, quarters and dimes, and there's a French franc in there. And the coins have been painted almost as if an archaeologist had found them, and they're a kind of taxonomical study of these coins.
And also, Daniel, yesterday there was a performance with you and Jonah Baker. Is this part of the exhibition as well, or is this something that you have another project in the future?
Jonah is a choreographer that I've worked with very frequently since his days dancing with Merce Cunningham's company. I was a scenographer with Merce for many years. Since that time, I've asked Jonah to perform in nearly every exhibition that I've done. I feel that if I can sort of introduce the audiences that are going to an art exhibition to this sort of performance work, it's a kind of blending of these audiences.
And but this performance actually was just a one-off in London, and I believe you're going to do something later in the year, right?
Yes, this performance that Jonah has staged is in relation to one of the works in the exhibition, and it's a kind of study for a larger performance work that we will premiere in Miami during Art Basel in December.
You seem to have quite a lot going on. You just told me that you have a new exhibition in the Netherlands as well. So how do you cope with all of this?
Well, I go to the studio every morning at 10 a.m. and I leave at 6, and I'm there whether or not I have things to do or ideas to pursue. It's a kind of a process, but I'm constantly curious about working in these different areas, and it's why I'm pursuing things in performance or in film or architecture.
And even there was an interesting thing, September, you did a collaboration with musician Pharrell Williams. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, collaboration is something that I'm very interested in, you know, to sort of enter someone else's world and learn from them. Pharrell and I have known each other for some years and have always discussed this idea of some sort of collaboration. He was over the studio a year or so ago discussing the objects that are on view here in London, these sort of relics from the past. And so I asked him, what was that thing for you? What was the device that was imperative to you at the beginning of your career? And for him, it was this Casio keyboard that he bought at Radio Shack in 1987. I then found that original keyboard and cast it in volcanic ash and crystal. You know, for me, it's sort of about taking something from the past and projecting it over the present into the future. It creates this confusion of time, which is where I like the work to reside.
So what next, Daniel, after London?
On Friday, I am headed to Singapore. I have a large exhibition there that's opening next week, half of which is paintings that I made 2 years ago on Easter Island, which is a remote island in the South Pacific. And I spent a number of weeks there painting the Moai on this island, you know, in some ways pretending to be an archaeologist.
That's wonderful.
And spending time with the archaeologists there. So I made 120 paintings that will be on display in Singapore. And in addition to that, I've collaborated with students from school there to generate a kind of fictional archaeology. So they've taken things from their own lives that are not used anymore, technological items. And we've used a very primitive casting technique, which is called sand casting. And it's where you have a moist sand, you push an object into it, and when you remove the object, you're left with the impression. You fill this in with plaster, and when you turn it over, you have a kind of aged version of the original, right? So they've cast thousands of these that will be on display in a kind of large gymnasium-like space, almost as if we're generating this fictional archaeological dig.
Did you ever think about becoming an archaeologist when you're younger? Because it seems to be quite present in your work.
You know, I loved Indiana Jones and those that sort of world. Archaeology, architecture, these things are present in my work, but in some ways are much too rigid and linear for me to be interested in pursuing. So I'm able to kind of operate on the periphery of them without being entirely bound by their rules.
That was Daniel Arsham, New York-based artist, whose exhibition opens today in London at the P.P. Holdsworth Gallery.
Well, in just a couple of minutes, we'll be joined by our news editor, Tom Edwards, for a run-through of today's European front pages. But first, some music from London-born, Vienna-based artist Son. Here's Lessons. And that was the very lovely sounds there of Son with Lessons.
8:52 in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Marco Sippi and Phila Hahn. And joining us now for a run-through of what is making the headlines in the UK today is Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards. Hello, Tom. How are you doing?
Good morning, Marcus. Good morning, Phil. Good morning. I'd just like to say it's always a pleasure to see you guys at this time of the morning.
Well, it's quite rare that we see you in at this time. So it's lovely to see you.
That's not funny, is it, Phil?
It's lovely to see you.
People are listening in. Come on.
What do you have for us this morning?
Well, let's start with the Telegraph. This is a story that just shows, I think, the level of Bashar al-Assad's lack of self-awareness. He has apparently made a joke, and listeners won't realise that I'm doing the inverted commas in the air, about that he deserved to win the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, ostensibly, that's kind of funny at first reading, until you actually recall the tens of thousands of people who died within Syria, many supposedly at his hand or at the hand of his administration for using chemical weapons. And he made a joking remark during a meeting with visitors at the presidential palace. This is according to a Lebanese newspaper, Al Akbar. He said, "It should have been mine." And he doesn't believe that the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons should have won, ironically.
Does the story tell what the reaction was in this event where he was
cracking
jokes?
But I imagine an uneasy silence.
A bothered one.
But, I mean, isn't that just a staggering indictment of someone's complete inability to grasp the viewpoint of the rest of the world?
I think this isn't the only case, actually. I remember him spreading some photographs. I think he joined Instagram, and if you checked his account, he was there, you know, spending family days at home and so on, trying to create this image of him as an ideal family father and so on.
It's staggering, isn't it, Mark Sippy?
It is. But moving on to another story, what else?
Yeah, what about in the Financial Times? This is quite interesting on their front page, a piece by their law courts correspondent. London's libel reputation for the rich and powerful dealt high court blow. Now, you're probably both familiar with this idea of libel tourism, people with these sort of specious claims, bringing them to Britain to try and prosecute here because our courts are more generous, they get better settlements. And a couple of very high-profile recent ones have been thrown out. Including one brought by a former policeman in Russia against Bill Browder, who was a UK fund manager who was involved in with various people who sort of claimed his misdeeds. The judge has thrown that out, saying it should have been brought in Russia. And another high-profile case brought by a Serbian national in Geneva, brought against Ratko Knezovic, a Montenegrin who lives in Croatia, about publications in Balkan newspapers. Now, the judge again said, this is not about your reputation in the UK. And the kind of the spurious reasoning was that these rumours had circulated within the online community within the UK. And the judge
exactly,
said,
which is
this,
kind
is
of...
just, this is just, this holds no water, this argument, and threw it out. So it could be very significant. And of course, there's a new Defamation Act coming in later this year, which I think, again, will make it much more difficult and should dissuade people from trying to bring these kind of libel cases within the UK courts.
Hoping for millions at that in terms of amounts, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And it seems to have a much kind of lower threshold than in courts, particularly in Europe as well.
You're already looking at the next paper. What's that?
Well, I know that, I think you've already talked about this morning on Monocle 24.
Oh, that's the BlackBerry letter.
Yeah, I just thought it was quite interesting. So this is in the Guardian. It's actually in most of the broadsheet papers here in the UK. This is BlackBerry's letter to their valued customers, partners and fans. And they have their one important message: you can count on us. And it is interesting if you think of the occasions when we see these sorts of advertisements and broadcasts from companies who are often trying to sort of reposition themselves, often trying to reassure consumers who have grave concerns. And one wonders whether it'll work. They boast a list of their impressive capabilities. They're talking about the productivity, best-in-class security, best-in-class enterprise mobility management, and social networking, of course. Sincerely, from the BlackBerry team.
That's exactly the question that Marcus asked our Jeffrey Kaufman earlier this morning on the program, whether you know these kind of things work. It's not going to really change whether you buy a BlackBerry if you see this kind of a letter, an open letter in a paper, is it?
Well, I wouldn't have thought so. I mean, I think a lot of these things, you know, they have strong brand loyalties. I think people who are committed BlackBerry fans will stay the same. They know the strengths
but
of the product.
But I smell desperation here.
Well, possibly, Marcus. I mean, I think what's interesting is that, you know, there's obviously a belief that they're, perhaps their consumers, you know, can still be influenced by, you know, a good old-fashioned piece of broadsheet advertising. And also a very heartfelt message. There's no glitz and glamour. This is, it's set out like an open letter. It's just text. They're not trying to grab people's attention. They're trying to grab their attention by the substance of what they're saying instead of the style with which they're saying it.
One more question. Are you going to finish this all with an animal story?
I like to bring you guys animal stories, right?
A good one.
There was a very sad news from London Zoo today about their tiger cub that had sadly perished in its enclosure. I've also got another. This is very marginally less depressing, but still depressing. Where have all the falcons gone? The peregrine falcon. I know you're a big fan.
In North American cities, they're very common sights now because they've had a bit of a comeback.
Well, it's not all about how great America is. Our own
well, I'm
ones.
Canadian, but continue.
I don't know if we've ever
anyway,
seen them in Finland.
There's been a terrible decline and there's bitter feuding between conservation groups and grouse shooters. Apparently, people are suggesting that people who shoot grouse have it in for the peregrine falcons because it ruins their hunting. Can you imagine that?
How dare they?
I can't.
But look at, there's a peregrine falcon. Look at its little chicks.
They're very puffy.
They're really cute. They're really cute, I know.
They're quite ugly, but...
That was Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards.
Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Annabelle Bly, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maddie Arruo, and our studio manager was Bill Ludi. Up next, after the news, is The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday London time. And don't forget that we have a very special edition of Aperitivo this evening at 1800 hours London time, live from London Freeze. I'll be back with Georgina Godwin for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Marcus Hippi. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.